I'm Matthew Petty and this is Intersection. For nearly 14 years, Larry Dale has run the Orlando Sanford International Airport. During that time, he doubled the airport's passenger count to over 2 billion people while overseeing a slew of developmental projects and the transition to private security screeners. This month, Dale announced his retirement. Dale speaks to me about his time as CEO of Orlando Sanford International and shares some words of advice for his replacement. But first, the Federal Aviation Administration says pilots must retire once they reach 65. A dwindling veteran pilot pool and low starting pay for right seat or co-pilots in some regional carriers has some industry experts worried about a pilot shortage. They say many airline transport pilot or ATP license holders won't consider regional airlines until pay improves. Dr. Tim Duncan from Embry-Riddle College of Aviation, Keith Hay from the Airline Pilots Association International, and analyst Bill Swellbard join me to discuss the potential impact of a pilot shortage here in the United States. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Tim Brady. He is the Dean of the College of Aviation at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's Daytona Beach campus. Dr. Brady, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Also joined on the phone by Keith Hagee. He's the Director of Engineering and Air Safety with the Airline Pilots Association International. Keith, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
And we're also joined on the phone by Bill Swellbar, co-founder of the Regional Air Service Alliance. And he is the regional vice president of Intervistas, which is a publisher of an analysis that looks at the pilot shortage impact. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Dr. Brady, I wanted to start with you. So we're facing, from my understanding, around 35,000 pilots are expected to retire in the next 6 years or so due to mandatory retirement at the age of 65. What kind of impact is this going to have overall on the airline industry?
It's already starting to have an impact in terms of being able to fill the cockpits of the regional airline aircraft. We see that they're having some troubles filling their classes. Some routes are being curtailed. Mayors are complaining to the Congress about having lost service. So there's an issue of having the qualified people that are available to fill those right-seat cockpits for the first officers.
Are there other factors, aside from this wave of folks retiring, are there other factors that are having, you know, feeding into this pilot shortage?
Well, there was a recent change to a regulation that required that pilots entering a right seat of a pilot of a Part 121 carrier, such as a regional carrier or a major carrier, would need to have 1,500 flight hours in the ATP. Prior to that, the rule was that they needed to have a commercial license. So that takes the amount of flight time from someone who could have been qualified into the right seat from about 350 hours to about 1,500 hours. So it's had an impact. Now, there is some relief from that. The FAA, by law, is authorized to allow certain colleges and universities that can meet certain standards to train their pilots to be able to enter the workforce at 1,000 hours with the restricted ATP. Mm-hmm. But there are just a few of those that are approved to do that. So it's caused a bit of an issue that is not yet completely resolved. So there are lots of issues that surround the current supply chain, but it's certainly having an impact. We have commissioned a study to look at the distribution of ATPs and commercial pilots throughout the country. And as it turns out, there are some 220,000 in that pool out in the U.S. Now, this pool is composed of commercial pilots and those with the ATPs. We needed to send out some 35,000 cards to try to enlist the responses from at least 1,700 pilots. Mm-hmm. And that study is just about complete. We're about 100 short of where we need to be. But I'll tell you, the data that we have so far is pretty darned interesting. We find that about 28% of them are currently airline pilots. They're serving in Part 121 carriers, either regionals or majors. And about 58% are not in airlines. And in fact, they state that they don't intend to work as an airline pilot. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge group out there. That 58% is about almost 128,000 pilots that are out there, but they say they don't intend to work for an airline. Mm-hmm. We said, what can motivate you to work for an airline? what salaries will motivate them to come out of whatever they're doing. They may be flying. They may be selling shoes. Who knows what they're doing. But to motivate them to come into the right seat of a Part 121 carrier, when you get a salary up to the 45 to 50K region, then you'll gain about 22%. 22% of those pilots out there right now.
And what are they making now? I mean, what's the starting salary?
Low, 20, 22, 25, somewhere in there. It's pretty very low.
Well, Keith Hager, I want to bring you in the conversation now from the Airline
Sure.
Pilots Association. Does this kind of match up with what pilots are saying? I mean, is there an impending shortage, and what kind of level is it at? Would you describe it as a crisis, perhaps?
Right now, I wouldn't label it as a crisis. I think what Tim is highlighting, it's about money. It's about salary and benefits right now. There are pilots out there. There are pilots to take the jobs that are available to them. It's just we're not paying them and we're not giving them the benefits commensurate with the experience and the expertise they possess.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we need to change. It, you know, listening to Tim also, it was interesting. I know there's carriers out there that have, you know, moved ahead of the issue, and they're not having problems now hiring new pilots. But what they've started doing is paying bonuses to offset the low entry-level salary, spreading that bonus over 3 to 4 years to bring the salary level up to, you know, the values that that you guys are talking about, get them in the mid-40s. I mean, primarily, what a pilot is looking for, it's like any professional. They're not looking for a job. They're looking for a career. And the younger folks that are coming into the business, they want to see career growth, career potential.
When you look at the median income, though, just based on U.S. Labor Department statistics, it seems like the median income for pilots is actually relatively good. And at the top end, you can make quite a lot of money if you're an international commercial pilot.
Right. At the larger carriers, yeah, you can do very well. But there's very few large carriers.
So the chances of a pilot who's graduating making only, you know, $25,000 or maybe even less at the start actually getting to one of those higher-paying six-figure salary jobs is quite slim?
And it takes time. And on top of that, they've got, I'm sure, educational debt they have to service and pay. So it is difficult.
Well, Bill Swellbauer, if I could bring you in the conversation, you know, who stands to be impacted most by this pilot shortage?
I would say it is the smaller communities and the airports located in those smaller communities that are ultimately the victims in all of this.
Is simply increasing salaries the answer, do you think?
I think that's part of the answer. One of the things that I struggle with as an observer of this issue is we don't talk enough about the fact that this is a really good time to be a pilot with all of the retirements going on. How it is that pilots make their money is moving from the left seat or the right seat to the left seat from a smaller airplane to a bigger airplane. And with all the retirements, there's a lot of seat movement that's available today and will be available for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm.
And so we spend an awful lot of time talking about that first year salary, but we really don't talk about the net present value of earnings over a career of a pilot. And I think we need to spend a little more time there than just talking about the $22,000 they make in the first year.
Well, Tim Brady, I mean, is that something that you tell your incoming students?
Right. And we did an analysis of how a professional pilot is paid over a lifetime, over a career. Compared to other professions. One of our stronger programs at the university is aerospace engineering. So we said, well, let's compare it to the aerospace engineer over a lifetime of income. The aerospace engineer, when they graduate, they're hired at a pretty good salary to start with, where the pilot is hired at a pretty low salary to start with. But if you look at the total lifetime earnings using data that's out there in the government sources, you'll find the pilot has a larger lifetime income than does the aerospace engineer. So that's the message that we need to get across to the young folks.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that the starting salary that we should accept it. I don't think we should. I think the industry shouldn't accept it. It's too low, and we've shown by this data that if you ratchet it up, you know, you're going to be able to increase the number of people that want to be in the right seat.
Keith Hagee, if I could come back to you, what other factors do you think are maybe suppressing those salaries? Why is it that you can pay a pilot as little as $22,000, $24,000 straight out of school?
Well, if you look at the regional carriers and the business model that they have to follow, it's the mainline carriers that go out and look for regional carriers to provide seats, to provide lift for them from some of the smaller communities to their main hubs. And they bid that out. So the carriers have to, it forces them down to a very low margin and in some markets to a loss. So what they try to do in order to make money, make a profit, and stay in business is they've got to save cost, and that does keep the salaries low.
Mm-hmm.
I would throw in, though, if you look at flight crew salary versus the hourly operating cost of an aircraft, it's only 6 to 8%. But that, again, demonstrates how thin the margin really is.
Mm-hmm. And is it a safety issue? I mean, if you're paying somebody as little as $24,000, I mean, does that sort of impact the kind of the quality of the people you're getting to fly the planes if you're constantly getting, you know, new graduates into those positions?
That's a great question to ask. And I would tell you, before the regulation that went into place in August of 2013, it was a safety issue. Because when you have pilots available that have 200 hours of flight experience and they are a product of an unstructured training program, they're willing to, everybody likes the lure of being an airline pilot. So they're willing to take a job at a very low salary versus a four-year university graduate that goes through a professional pilot program. They're going to be looking for more income because they've got a choice, be a pilot or use my university degree. Which is going to give me the ability to provide for a family and carry the, you know, whatever my loan debt is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after August of 2013, when the regulation went into effect, it accounted for in the regulation varying qualities of training programs. So you could qualify to move into the cockpit at lower flight hours than the 1,500 hours that was specified in the legislation. And you guys highlighted 750 for military, 1,000 hours for a university grad.
Bill Swelberg, question for you. Do you think there's also maybe an issue with better conditions in other countries? Is that also maybe a way for pilots to be drawn away from the sort of regional market here in the United States?
We know that to be the case. I mean, certainly when the industry went through the very difficult last decade and we were furloughing many, many pilots, because of the financial condition of the U.S. airlines, many of them found their way to foreign carriers. So, yes, that is indeed a draw on some of the labor pool as well.
What are airlines here doing to try and combat that, if anything?
Well, I mean, certainly what it is that's nice to see, again, is we're seeing a stable industry. We're seeing an industry that is restoring much of the pay and, you know, profit sharing now for employees, and pilots are actually being compensated very, very nicely today at the mainline level. So I think, you know, one of the things that's good about a stable industry earning profits is they are investing in their people. And so I think that's going to go a long way to retaining folks from looking at alternatives. Again, to get back to the, you know, the career earnings, it's, again, I think it's a pretty good time to consider the piloting career, assuming that, of course, we do something with the regional pay at the year one and year two level.
Mm-hmm. Tim Brady, do you think that bigger airlines have more of a responsibility in terms of helping foster some of those smaller airlines and, you know, making sure that conditions are good so they have that pool of workers to come through?
Well, in my Pollyanna mind, that would be the one of the solutions, but I don't really think that's going to happen. I think that other actions are going to have to be taken. I'd love to see the major step up to the plate because mm-hmm. they are the beneficiaries of the airlines programs, the regional airline programs, because when they need someone to fill one of their seats, they go to the regional airlines and pull the pilot from there. So I'd love to see a situation where the majors helped out the situation in terms of pay for regional airline first officers. That would be great. I'm not going to hold my breath until that occurs, but that's a potential solution.
Mm-hmm. Keith Hagee, where are pilots going if they're not going into these regional airlines? What other options are there out there for them?
Well, if they're a product of a college or a university, they can use their degree. And that is what they are doing. I mean, I've got a couple friends that, you know, went away on furlough. They were pilots. They got furloughed, and they decided to stay, you know, with their profession that they picked up on and use their degree during their furlough period. They chose not to come back to the carrier. Mm-hmm. And when you go through a quality college and university, you do have that option, and that's the balance that you have to create. I do want to circle back to Tim. And this is a debate and a friendly discussion that we'll have for years to come, I hope. But the main benefit I see in that regulation that went into effect on August 1st of 13 was finally we had training regulations in the FARs that recognized quality of program versus strictly counting flight hours of experience. And to me, that made all the difference in the world. They and those regulations, a lot of people think they came as a result of one accident up in Buffalo. There were actually mm-hmm. four different accidents over a five-year period that unfortunately we lost over 100 passengers in those four accidents.
And that one accident you're referring to is the Buffalo, New York accident in 2009?
That was the final one, mm-hmm. right.
Tim Brady, some final thoughts. How do you see this pilot shortage situation playing out in the near term and, I guess, sort of 5 years on from now?
So my view is there needs to be some kind of a federal or some sort of a program that's going to be a loan program that pilot candidates, not necessarily university, because the university folks get financial aid. I'm talking about the non-university pilots that at one point fill that tube coming in for pilot source. They're not there anymore. Those mm-hmm. loans need to be put back into effect.
Keith Hagee from the Airline Pilots Association, what are your thoughts? How do you see the situation sort of playing out in the next little while?
We got to get our arms around it because longer term we are going to have a shortage. And I think the key is we got to provide that career, not the job. We got to provide a career. In a career with growth and long-term potential and stability.
Bill Swelbar, what are your thoughts on how the situation is going to play itself out?
I'll take probably a different tact here, and that is just taking a look at the small and medium-sized communities that rely on commercial air transportation as they're linked to the global economy. And I can envision a regional industry that is a fraction of itself and an airport system that is 150 to 200 airports less than it is today by 2022.
We're speaking to Bill Swelbar. He's from the Regional Air Service Alliance, also Regional Vice President of Intervisis. Bill, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also joined on the phone by Keith Hagee. He's the Director of Engineering and Air Safety with the Airline Pilots Association International. Keith, thank you very much for joining us too.
Yeah, thank you, Matthew.
And in the studio here, Dr. Tim Brady, the Dean of the College of Aviation at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's Daytona Beach campus. Dr. Brady, thank you very much for stopping by.
Been a pleasure. Anytime.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. You can reach out to us on Facebook or send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. After the break, a conversation with outgoing Orlando Sanford International Airport CEO Larry Dale. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm joined by Larry Dale. Larry is the President and CEO of Orlando Sanford International Airport. Larry, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you. Good to be here.
This may be a silly question, but is Orlando International Airport your direct competition?
No, not really. I mean, they're the 800-pound gorilla. You know, we love Orlando. It's a beautiful airport, but it is rather crowded. Getting through security and grabbing your baggage and getting your rental cars and things of that nature, much more difficult than here simply because of the volume. So we are a leisure airport. We don't cater to the business travel because business wants six flights a day, 7 days a week. Allegiant flies three or four or five times a week, one time a day. And their niche is travel, leisure. Mm-hmm. Travel. So we're, you know, we don't really compete with them. We have a different niche market.
Do you think a business could be a future for
I think so. Sanford? Yeah. Yeah, I think as we get airlines that realize the advantages that we have here, that we'll probably get some that fly six, seven days, 7 days a week. We're already working with some, but I can't name who they are because they get mad at me if I report something that we haven't reached an agreement on. But I can see that in the near future, 4 or 5 years.
How about the size of the, you know, the location as well? I mean, you talked about some of the infrastructure improvements that have happened in your 14 years here, but do you think, is there more in the future for Orlando Sanford?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have, you know, we've got 3,200 acres now, thereabouts, so we've added a lot of land for our approaches and safety. We've extended our runway to 11,000 feet so we can handle the largest aircraft that fly in the world. We have good instrument approaches, and our terminal is easy to get in and out of. Our parking is good. So we're going to have to grow some. We're going to have to add to our terminals, and we're going to have to add to our parking.
Talk to me a little bit about the security situation here, because you've been quite an outspoken advocate of freeing things up as far as, you know, who runs the security. How has that gone for Sanford?
Well, the TSA still runs it. They oversee the contract. It's their contract. You know, the private screening program was passed by Congress back when they passed the Homeland Security and created TSA. Five airports were pilot projects for that. All five of them have remained private. They've had opportunities to go back to the government operated ones, but they've stayed private because, and we, of course, looked into that probably 3 or 4 years ago, my board, and traveled to several of them, and it looked like it was a good program. I grew up in the fact that America was unique in that we encouraged private business and private ownership. I mean, way back to the Homestead Act, when we had all the government land, we said, let's put that in private hands because that's what built America. And I firmly believe that. I think private enterprise is a keystone to efficiency and the American way. And I believe that these private screeners here are doing a good job. They came in and started a transition, I think, in November. Mm-hmm. And they took over February the 1st. So they've only been doing it, what, 4, 5, 6 weeks? And they're doing a good job. There's been, you know, a little bit of a learning curve and the fact that the transition had to go, but it's the TSA Assistant Federal Security Director, the manager here, meets with my staff, as does the project coordinator for Trinity, who is our private company here. And they were just giving me a report Friday of how well it was going. Mm-hmm. So I've gotten a lot of good comments from traveling public about how well they're being treated and how efficient it is. And doesn't take the TSA out of it. It's still their contract. They did the RFP, chose Trinity to do it. Trinity's doing a fine job, and I can't see anything but an upswing in efficiency and them keeping up with our growth because we are growing. And so you can't have a static security team's got to grow with it.
Do you see the privately contracted security screeners? I mean, are more airports going to pick it up?
I think so. You know, the big airport to the south of us, my friends down there have reached out to me to see how our experience has been. They've had an advisory committee that is now going to make a decision here coming up soon about doing that, and I think there's a good chance that they may opt out to go with a private screening program. I know John Micah is pushing that all over the country.
So now, you know, you've got your private screeners in. They've been doing the job for just about a month and a half now. And you're 6 months off from retiring. I mean, you must be quite happy that this is actually now in operation.
I'm glad to see it. I'm glad that it came in before, you know, I had to retire and I got to see how it worked and be a part of that. Because my retirement was not something that I wanted to announce too soon, but I knew my contract, you know, my last 3-year contract was expiring September 30th. And, you know, you don't want to stay too long. You know, some people sometimes try to stay too long. It's time, you know, you need to go out when you're still young enough. I'm 67, and I think I'm still young enough and healthy enough to, you know, bounce down that rocky road, enjoy life, but I'm old enough and financially secure enough to retire, so you have to pick a point that, you know, move on to the next era. So, but, yeah, I'm glad I got to be be a part of 7 or 8 months of this. So,
you've been mayor of Sanford. You've been the leader of a major airport in Central Florida. I mean, is this going to be retirement for real, or do you have other things in mind?
I don't think I ever want to really retire. You know, I'm an airline transport pilot. You know, I'll probably enjoy flying corporate aircraft. I've been in the real estate development construction business most of my adult life, myself employed for a number of years. And, you know, I was mayor of Sanford back in, ran in 96 until 2001, March. But that was a part-time position, and my forte has been, I've lived in Alaska and Wyoming and developed construction, building houses. That was my primary business, and, I was fairly successful in that, so I may probably still get back into doing something in real estate. I still have my brokerage firm, H.A. Dale Realty, and although it's been inactive all these years, I'm probably activate that. And No, I don't want to sit on a rocking chair. You know, I like the outdoors. I love to fish, love to hunt, love to travel, visit friends in Wyoming, Montana, Alaska, and Texas. I'll be doing some of that. But I have 5 daughters, and I have 6 grandchildren now and another one on the way. And I just had my first great-grandchild. He's 5 months old. So, I'm going to enjoy getting out there and getting them in the outdoors and doing things with them. So, although 2 of them live in Tennessee and 2 of my grandchildren do too, I'll be free to travel up there more often also. So, I'm looking forward to getting out and enjoying my retirement years, but not retiring to the standpoint that I'll sit on the rocking chair and wonder what I'm going to do that day.
What would you say to the next person taking on this job?
Be sure you're not the bulldog chasing a dump truck. You might catch it. No, I think this is a rewarding and challenging airport, growing still. You know, there's a difference between maintaining an airport and growing an airport. You know, growing an airport, you have to be willing to take those calculated risks. Business is a risk. So anybody that wants to be a caretaker need not apply. Need to be growth-oriented.
I've been speaking to Larry Dale. He's the president and CEO of Orlando Sanford International Airport. Larry, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection is produced by Brendan Byrne. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.